Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Discover North Korea. This is episode 30, and unfortunately, I do have some roadworks going on in the background, so I'm very, very sorry if you can hear those throughout. This will actually be the last podcast of this series, as I mentioned in the last episode, and we are truly going out with a bang with several guests on the show today, three of them, in fact. Don't worry, I will be back after I have finished my trip. I also have pretty exciting new plans for a new podcast. That doesn't mean that I will be giving up on this podcast at all. It simply means that I am traveling for the next month and a half and I will not have easy access to a microphone and computer equipment in order to edit and publish this podcast. Plus, I'd like a little bit of a break. So for the next few weeks, I won't be updating this podcast, but I will actually be spending my time on the move recording a new, rather different podcast. In the past few weeks, I asked you guys on Instagram how you would like it if I were to record my travels. Now, I know this is a bit of a strange concept. Travel is largely inherently visual, a visual experience. But I enjoyed recording the podcast where I took you to Dandong and the North Korean border so much when I was pretty much live podcasting what I was seeing, what I was feeling, what I was hearing, and ultimately what I was experiencing the whole time. I really enjoyed doing that style. And because I have a lot of travel plans over the next few months, luckily enough, with various different projects, and I'm going to some pretty interesting places, including the South Pacific, potentially Tuvalu as well, which is one of those, it's a country that's disappearing, and also Socotra in an island in Yemen. So I have a lot of interesting plans, and I thought it would be an interesting experiment to kind of record those down. So I'm going to start a new podcast on that, and I'll get editing that once I am back from my travels over August. You can expect to find that around mid-September time. If anyone has any ideas of the name of the podcast, do let me know. But it will include at least three countries. I'll be going to New Zealand, Samoa, and Tonga. But it might also include another couple as well, Kiribati and Tuvalu. So they're all in the South Pacific. If you've never heard of them before, they're all very small island nation countries. Don't worry if you've never heard of them, but very, very unique countries. And I'm super excited to be going back to the South Pacific. If you don't know why I'm going, then where have you been? I am filming a super exciting documentary actually in Tonga, but that's all a very different story. I want to get into our this podcast, this episode. Let's get straight into it. Basically, I want to first introduce our guests. We have three guests on the show. One you will already know. They'll do their own introductions. But Greg, he's a regular on this podcast now, and we all love him. Leslie and Peter. I took Peter into North Korea in 2019 on the summer holiday tour. And Leslie is also an ex-choreo tour. She took a tour with Greg, and she's also been to North Korea a couple of times as well. Now, we will be talking largely about, the topic of this podcast is about a South Korea, a Korea-themed tour that Greg from Choreo Tours, together with NK News, is leading. And it's a very interesting, very different tour. And I wanted to introduce it for you guys because you have the opportunity to join it later this year. There are still a few limited places left. So if you, like me, at the end of this podcast was convinced that you want to join, then all of the information will be in the show notes. It's truly a very interesting tour and definitely one for those who are interested in North Korea and are desperate to go but cannot go because of border closures or also because of, you might be a US national or a South Korean who cannot enter into North Korea. This tour basically goes from east to west, trailing the military demarcation line, trailing the North Korean border, but it's set completely in South Korea. And they go to some pretty unique and hard to reach places, definitely off the beaten tourist track. And a big appeal to this tour as well is the people that you will meet along the way. So, without further ado, let's get into episode 30 and the final episode in this podcast series. All right, so welcome to the show, all my guests. It's amazing having three of you here. I'm going to ask each of you to introduce yourselves a little bit first. Greg, friend of the podcast, you've been on here before, but maybe we can start with you, and then Leslie and Peter, you can follow. Greg, go for it.
Right. Hello, everyone, and thank you for Leslie and Peter for joining. I'm happy to see you again after almost a year. Most of you, of the listeners, should know me, but just in a nutshell, I'm a tour manager and tour leader, or a former tour manager and tour leader at Choreo Tours, is currently living in Iceland. I'm back in the business to an extent that I'm going to lead a second tour to South Korea, which is focusing on North Korea. That's how I met Leslie and Peter. And we had amazing conversations on the tour. And since it's really important to, put it out in the public that you have this kind of tour and how much you can learn about it, I told that we will invite Leslie and Peter to join us and to, talk about their experience. And currently I'm in Normandy. Potentially has some connection to Korea because I'm not far from Utah Beach, where supposedly they captured a Korean prisoner of war in German uniform. It's not verified though, but they made a very nice movie about it and so on. So basically the story is that there is a person, an Asian-looking man in German uniforms, and the story behind it that potentially was a Korean who was recruited to the Imperial Japanese Army. Then he became a prisoner of war of the Soviet Red Army. Then the Soviets put him in the battleground in Kharkiv. Then the Germans captured him. And then the Germans put a uniform on him. And then he was stationed in Normandy. And then on D-Day, he surrendered to the Americans. It's not a verified live story, but there is a possibility that it happened. And there is a South Korean movie called My Way, which is about this story, which also adds a little bit of a twist into it, that he is supposed to be, like, the character in the movie is the first gold medalist in the Olympics for South Korea. However, under Japanese Imperial flag in marathon.
Wow.
Yes.
Please tell me that this isn't the reason why you went to Normandy.
No. The reason is that I've been in a healthy way obsessed with the Operation Overlord and D-Day. because of the movie The Longest Day. So I just wanted to, and for like 25 years, my dream was to come to Normandy and see where it all happened and where The Longest Day, the movie and the book, takes place.
Excellent. We love a healthy obsession. Leslie, do you want to introduce yourself?
Hi. So I'm actually a former journalist, and I live in Sydney, Australia, though I'm a Kiwi by birth. I got interested in North Korea. Actually, it was a summer book read recommendation from a friend, and they said, if anyone's looking for a book to read, there's this book, Dear Leader. And I read it and I thought, gosh, you know, it was a novel, but you sort of thought, is some of that true? Is none of it true? So it just sort of got me thinking, and working at the university, I was aware of a professor who actually was researching women in North Korea, and got talking to her. And I sort of ended up having this unofficial education. She would say, oh, you must read this book. Oh, read this book, read another book. And then eventually she said to me, I'm going to North Korea. Would you like to come? So, and I sort of said, I can't go to North Korea. But anyway, I did end up going to North Korea with the professor, and ended up taking lots of photos, some of which are being used in her research. She's got a book coming out soon, and some of the photos will be in there. So I visited twice, 2015 with her, and I went back in 2018 with some PhD students, and again, a bit of an academic tour. Really interesting traveling with people like that, and just, you know, it's just a fascinating place. But I knew that I needed to go to South Korea. I knew that having been to North Korea twice, I had to compare it to something. I had to see the differences. So that's why when Greg's tour popped up, and I'd been waiting, you know, 2 years through COVID, and Greg's tour popped up, and I thought, this is perfect. This is exactly the tour I want to do. So, yeah.
Yeah. It's definitely aimed at exactly your audience, I would say, like academics or like people with, you know, like that kind of interest in North Korea and general Korean Peninsula relations and stuff. So that's really great to hear. And you went to North Korea first, which is not something that a lot of people can say. People always ask me, you know, did you go to North or South first? Actually, I went to South Korea first, but it's always a bit of a novelty. I remember I had one person on tour, that it was his literal, I mean, actually not because he had to go to China first, but it was his literal first ever travel. So North Korea, had he have been able to go straight, I can't remember his home country, but had he been able to go straight from his home country to North Korea without having to transit through China, that would have been his first ever country. So,
it wasn't that unique that because we had some other tourists whose first overseas trip was to North Korea. I remember on the last tour which Americans could attend, that was the Beer Festival Tour, Pyongyang Beer Festival Tour 2017. There was a Korean American who just hopped on the plane and went to North Korea as his first overseas trip just before it became unavailable for Americans. And also I had a family from Argentina where the parents who traveled with the son and his fiance, that's what was their first overseas trip. So yeah, for some, this is the first trip ever.
Which is quite incredible. And Peter, let's have a little bit of an introduction from you first. And tell us where you've been before North Korea as well. first trip?
Okay, right from the start, I'm a Kiwi. And I've been basically, I left New Zealand, I think in 1970, 71. And I was going to travel for a year, and 50 years later, I'm still traveling. I've never given up, you know. So I've got infinite curiosity in everything. And first of all, I went to the UK. I went to university in the UK at the Royal School of Mines. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I got a job in the US. I worked in the US a couple of years. Then I got a job in Sweden. And so I basically worked all over the place, but I'm basically a mining engineer. I moved into finance about 40 years ago. So I describe myself now as a resource stockbroker. And part of that is running around the world, looking at mining opportunities all around the world for investment purposes. So I've seen it all, you know. I've had hits on this. I've seen everything. So, and then this chance to come to North Korea came up. I was getting a bit bored one day and I thought, what will I do to break the boredom? And I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll go to North Korea. And I rang up a couple of friends and everyone said to me, mate, you're crazy. Why do you want to go to North Korea? Well, it's just curiosity. You know, I've been driven by curiosity from day one and I'm just curious. And I found North Korea to be, you know, a great place to go, a great trip. And that's basically the story, actually. I'm just always looking around for interesting experiences, you know, and I've never really given up. And my last interesting experience, actually, I'll tell you once the podcast is over, but that's something else again, okay?
Oh, is it not podcast friendly?
Yeah. So look, that's my background, mate. And I'm still traveling. I'm basically retired now. You know, I retired about 12 months ago, but I've got this curiosity, you know, and I think there are two types of people in this world, people that are curious and people that are not. And if you're curious, you never give up, you know? Mm. And I'm just basically curious. It's got me into a lot of trouble, but it's been a lot of fun along the way, I can tell you. Yeah,
I can definitely relate. I think when people ask me why I travel so much, and, you know, I used to think that it was like a normal thing to want to travel so much and to want to find out so much and to be so curious. And then people started, like when I started to grow older and then I started to realize like, hey, why are you just sitting at home and doing nothing? And why don't you, you know, people would ask me, why do you travel so much? And I'm like, am I not normal? And then I realized, like, you know, most people actually don't. That's when I realized.
Look, yeah. Most people don't embrace change. You know, most people like to live a pretty constant life. No, I just embrace change. I just get bored very quickly. You know, and my job, when I was working, it took me 1 year to learn my job, then 1 year to do it well. And then I was bored. It was time to do something else. And my whole life has been like that, you know, series of doing it well, getting bored, trying onto something else. And North Korea was just part of it. You know, this is part of something that goes back many, many years, mate. This is not just something that came out of the blue, you know. So, you know, and part of that, like in the last 15 years or so, I've been doing a high altitude mountaineering too and nearly killed myself a couple of times. So,
oh my gosh.
I've been out there. I've been out there on the limits, right out there on the limits now for a long, long time. And North Korea, quite frankly, was, you know, pretty soft compared to some of the other stuff I've been up to. But anyhow, that's a story for another day. Yeah.
So what, Peter, why did you decide to join this South Korea trip? Was it your first time in South Korea or?
The reason I decided to go to South Korea was I found the North Korean trip was great, but it was a bit of a bubble. You go there in a bubble. You've got certain people with you. You have certain limited contact with North Koreans, but it's very limited. The South Korean trip looked like it was far broader reach, and we can probably get onto this later, but I just found the South Korean trip was a totally different experience. You know, it was extremely informative. The North Korean thing was great from a visual point of view, but it was a looking trip, okay? And also the people in the trip were totally different. The North Korean trip we did, they were younger, you know? The trip into South Korea, there were some serious intellects there, you know, some serious, serious people and some great conversations. And the presence of the US military also was fantastic. You know, I learned so much from it. The North Korean trip was a great visual trip, but the learning part of the experience was really in South Korea.
Yeah, totally. And just to give people a little bit of context as well, I actually went with Peter to North Korea. It was 2019, no, 2018.
It was about 2018 or 2019, mate. 2020. I've lost track, you know.
Yeah.
It was about that.
Yeah. COVID happened.
I think we were basically the last trip into North Korea. We went about August, and I think about 3 months later, they shut the whole place down.
Exactly, yeah. So it was 2019, and we went on like a summer holiday tour. And that trip was a lot of young people, I have to say, actually. The age group was probably on average a little bit younger than we usually have, and I think that's because it coincides with summer holidays from university and stuff like that as well. So that's a little bit of context with that one. And
there was also at the end changing demographics for the Korea Tours customers. So it was a bit more like the South Korean trip in many tours, and then because of competition and so on, we had to change a little bit, and that also shifted in the demographics.
Yeah. So, which is a good thing.
yes and no.
But almost by definition, the trip to North Korea had to be a lot different from South Korea, just from a communicating point of view. I mean, there's limited things you can say in North Korea, limited people you can contact with. The South Korean thing was open to everyone. And on top of that, it was amplified by the fact of the quality of the people on the trip and also the speakers that they brought in. And that was a result of doing something with NK News. NK News was a great addition there. And I would say, if you can do that in North Korea, bring in other North Korean organisations that are prepared to talk about these things, and the answer is probably no. But I just thought the format for the South Korean trip was just fantastic, quite frankly.
It's interesting you say that, because I feel like we do, in some respects, have these kind of organised things in North Korea, certainly not to the same extent as a South Korean tour, which we will, I promise to listeners, get onto in a minute. But I think you make an interesting point that if we set up something like that in North Korea, then a lot of people, you then get the backlash of this is staged, this is curated. And so it's the, you know, this vicious circle that you get into North Korea is, these things would be great, but I can imagine the kind of comments that we get on it. It's like people would not enjoy it because they would say, well, it's all for a show, it's all staged. You know, you actually have a load of explanations and really in-depth explanations in some places that you go, but a lot of people, it just flies right over their head because they're in that whole, well, this is North Korea, they have to say this.
There's a way to handle that, Zoe, and that is, I think you could run different trips to North Korea with different focuses, you know. Like the trip I was with you was really a tourist thing. You know, we had a look around and everyone had a great time and it was a great trip. But there's another class of person that would go to North Korea that had a far different focus. I reckon you could run different trips into North Korea depending on different people's interests.
We kind of try, and I really want to do a hiking tour, for example. And we kind of tried this specific tours, but the problem is that the market is so small that there is a very tricky point when either we don't have enough people or it makes it so expensive because you know that there is going to be a limited amount of people that people want to sign up. I think with the hiking tour, at least, we could run it like every 2 or 3 years, because in 2 or 3 years we will, you know, have enough people. And I think that's one of the reasons why one of our competitors stamped their aviation tours. They had an amazing tour, and you could fly all Air Koryo aircrafts. It was like for aviation enthusiasts. And then after a while, they just had to stop it because all the people who were interested in aviation has already been on the tour, and the pool of people just emptied.
But
I think, but nevertheless, we should always, you know, try, because if you don't try, we don't know how it would work out. So probably when the country opens up, we can do this experiment as well. Yeah. And we focus on one specific area and then see how it goes. And now people probably are North Korea information thirsty. So maybe now is going to be the best time to try again. It's specialist tours in North Korea.
I have to say, I found it fascinating that Kurio Travel teamed up with NK News to run a joint trip. And that added so much to the trip. And I'm not sure whether it's possible to do a similar joint arrangement in North Korea with some North Korean organisation also. Mm. The answer is probably not. But I just raised the subject because I just thought what NK News brought to the table on top of what Kurio Travel brought to the table, I thought was just fantastic. And then that started building on itself as the tour went on. Mm. I mean, there were some fascinating people on that trip. In fact, I would go as far as to say some of the people on the trip were as interesting as some of the people that were brought in from outside. I mean, there was some real experience on that South Korean trip there. And it started coming out. And, you know, when I do a trip, I look certain expectations. And quite often on the trip, I get far more than that. Well, I can tell you the trip to South Korea, my expectations were exceeded many, many times over. And a lot of it was not just the Kurio Travel and the NK News, but the people on the trip themselves contributed so much. I mean, there were very high class, I don't normally like organised trips, mate. So for me to come out and give a big twit to an organised trip, even though, look, there were certain organisational things you could have criticised, but the main thing was that there was such a synergy of people and all that. The whole thing was going the whole time. I mean, people from the US military, for instance, you know, they were seriously smart people. I learned a lot about the US military on that particular trip. And, mm-hmm. you know, it was just a fascinating trip. I don't know what you think.
My biggest worry about the trip, I can say this now, so particularly being a woman, I remember the first evening and I came down and everyone was standing there. And at that time, I was the only woman, you know, like people were still gathering. Yeah. And I was sort of coming out of the lift area and it just went through my mind. I thought, oh, my God, what have I let myself in for? Who are these people going to be? But actually, within about 10 minutes, I went, hey, these people are really interesting. And it was kind of a relief when a couple of women turned up as well. But yeah, I think you're absolutely right. The tour itself is fantastic. It's got sort of great elements to it. But actually, equally as fantastic was just the absolute diversity of people on that bus, you know, and it ranged from youngish people. Through to people like Peter and myself, with many years of seasoned judgment. So it was absolutely fascinating and just all sorts of backgrounds. So there were a couple of US military people on the trip, but basically on holiday because they wanted to explore this idea as well. There were other journalists, there were people from embassies in Seoul who wanted to sort of go out and learn on this trip as well. It was absolutely amazing. Such a great diversity of people. And every day I would talk to someone different and they were all fascinating. So it was one of my favourite things about the trip, actually.
There was one guy that had worked on aid stuff into North Korea many times. Yeah. And he had actually seen an operation in a North Korean hospital where they never used anaesthetics. They took a woman's appendix out, I think it was, without anaesthetics. You know, just, you know, the type of things you'd never hear in North Korea. But it was a reflection of what goes on in North Korea. There were people like that there, people with enormous experience being in and out of North Korea. Whereas the North Korean trip that I was on was more a lot of young people that were going there to tick a box they'd been to North Korea. Mm. And it was a great trip and all of that. But it was a totally different experience from the South Korean one. There were people in the amongst the guests there that knew as much as some of the speakers. Mm. You know, there was a very, very high quality audience.
Amazing.
So it was serious, sorry, but also fun. So
and a huge amount of fun too.
It was a huge amount of fun. I mean, so there was a lot of learning and talking and sharing, but at the same time, boy, we had some really, you know, we had great food. We had a few beers, you know, found strange cafes and strange places. had the best crab stew I've ever had in my life. So all equally like serious, but also a huge amount of fun as well. So, and I think again, because of that diversity of people.
There was a South Korean female officer there that was great on the karaoke. You know, you see her grab a karaoke thing, she's out of control, you know. So there was a huge amount of entertainment went on. But there was it was run at a very high intellectual level most of the time also. It was a lot of fun and it was a great trip actually.
Mm-hmm. I am loving the enthusiasm and amazing feedback for the tour. Unfortunately, most of our listeners still don't know what on earth is the tour that we're talking about. So I'm going to put everyone who's listening out of their misery. Just before I do that, Peter, I just want to say, in terms of the specialist tours as well, and for anyone that's listening, Koryo Tours do actually have a whole section on their website for specialist tours. And that is generally for people that have a specialism and that maybe have a little bit more money and they can do a private tour and we can facilitate things like a golfing tour or, you know, an aviation tour and anything that you could imagine that you have an interest in North Korea tour, Koryo Tours can do it. But obviously these tours generally tend to be private tours just because, as we were making the point before, you know, if there's not enough interest, we can't make it into a tour. I want to pass the mic over to Greg now for a few minutes as you basically give us a little bit of a rundown on what on earth this tour is that apparently is so great. I mean, I've never been on it. I want to join this year now after hearing all you guys speak about it. Greg, let us, give us an intro.
So basically there's a history of Korea Tours trying to arrange tour into South Korea. And it became more present when I joined the tour because I always tried to understand the Korean Peninsula as a whole, not just north and south opposing each other. But honestly, it didn't really work out. We had only three customers joining our One Korea tour, traveling to the north and to the south. And then the pandemic came and no one could travel anywhere. And that was true for Chad O'Carroll, who is the head of NK News. He's stuck in South Korea. So he started to travel in South Korea. And he started to discover all the places around along the border, the DMZ. And then they reached out to us, probably because they knew that back then I was living in South Korea, that, hey, if Korea opens up, like South Korea, then we should arrange a tour and to see the value of the tourist sites along the southern side of the DMZ on how much you can potentially learn about, or at least if not necessarily learn, but start to think about North Korea. And then that's how this whole tour came about. We visited, and we're going to visit this year. Most of the things available from this time, from west to east. So we're going to go to Yeongpyeongdo, which is a small island on the West Sea, or the Sea of China, if some people like it better. Which is around the northern limit line, which is the extension of the demarcation line on the mainland. And also that's the area where some sea battles took place in 2002 during the World Cup. Also there was a shelling by North Korea of the island. One of the main sites is actually dedicated to that, the civilian security learning center or something like that. And then we're going to visit obviously more reachable places like the observatories near Seoul and Paju. Potentially the joint security area. However, now, to be honest, a little bit of concern because of the recent events, if it's going to be possible. We can talk a little bit about it a bit later if anyone wants. And then the Chorwon, which is kind of the midpoint of the DMZ on the mainland. And I think there we have one of the best observatories, Victory Observatory. I'm not sure if you guys remember, but that's where we got closest to the border. And that's where we tried to figure out the two different fences on the... I think that's the best observatory because that really represents how the DMZ looks like, nature-wise and also the military installations. And then we will go as far as Kosong. Kosong is known to be the only township in Korea, which is divided between the north and the south. And actually the whole area is supposed to belong to the north, but it just, you know, shifted as on the west coast is the other way around. And that's where you can see Kumgangsan, and you can see also the facilities they used to use for facilitating inter-Korean tourism processing between the two countries. And then we did visit two museums and so, which is, I guess, related to the whole issue, the War Memorial or the Korean War Museum, and also the Contemporary History Museum, to have background knowledge about how South Korea developed after 1945. Because not much is being talked about that. Like most of the people think that, you know, after 1945, South Korea was a democracy. Mm. It started its own miraculous economic development. No, until 1990, South Korea was a quite tough dictatorship, and there were some very similar things to North Korea. For example, the length of the skirt women could use, also recommended hairstyles. Pornography, for example, is still banned in South Korea as of today. So I think that museum also adds value to the tour. But this year we won't have the other touristy sites in Seoul. That's something our guests will have to arrange for themselves.
I was just about to ask you.
Yeah, so that is in a nutshell. And obviously in the evenings, we will have guest speakers to talk about certain aspects of North Korea. We will have Professor Lankov during our trip, who will talk about all things North Korea related, like how they start a business in North Korea, for example. That was pretty informative, how the construction industry works, et cetera, and then some people who have experience living in North Korea, some people have experience working with North Koreans in negotiations. So we will have a great pool of guest speakers as well.
Yeah.
So this is the second time that the tour is running. Is there any reason why you changed it from east to west, west to east?
Yes, logistics. As Leslie and Peter will recall, we had some worries at the end of the tour when we were going to Yeongpyeongdo. The ferry is not reliable in a sense that it's very sensitive to weather and cancellations are possible. So we decided to go on the ferry ride first at the very beginning of the tour, so that no one has to worry about how to get out of the island and if they're going to catch the flight back to wherever they are flying. So that's the main reason, logistics.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And you took out originally there was a little bit in Seoul, right? But I was going to ask you the question, you know, for the first time in South Korea, people obviously want to see a little bit of Seoul. But I think you answered that for me, is that if someone was to come on this tour, they should arrange that for themselves beforehand or afterwards, I suppose, because there's nothing normal touristy about this tour, as far as I can understand. It's very specialized, and if you do want to do the touristy stuff, you have to do that in your own time.
I actually came 10 days beforehand,
and right, I did, 10 days.
Yeah, so I came and saw, you know, the bits of Seoul. I hope to go to Jeju, typhoon got in the way. That's exactly what I did. I did 10 days beforehand and then I did the tour. So that's what I would recommend to people. It's a good way of doing it too. I acclimatized before I actually went on the tour. Yeah.
And Leslie, as an add-on to that, what I would say is if you go to North Korea first, if you've got a choice between North Korea first and South Korea, go to North Korea first, because you come out of North Korea with a lot of questions that aren't answered. But in South Korea, on the trip we were on, there were so many specialists there, you could get answers that you'd never get in North Korea. And they weren't propaganda answers. These were people that seriously knew what they were talking about. Like Professor Lankov, Leningrad University, studied in Pyongyang University, was a professor at ANU in Australia. I mean, was flown into the United States to advise Obama on Korean policy. I mean, there were some high-level people there, including the counselor, the political counselor for the Japanese embassy. There were people there from the European Union, of very, very high level. And a lot of these people had a lot of Korean specialties and a lot of knowledge. So it really added to the whole thing. I don't know what you think, Greg.
Yes, I do agree. And I also learned from some of the people who came on tour. But actually, it happens most of the time. On a regular tour, I usually learn from questions. On this tour, I was learning from the conversations. I do agree with Peter that it is advisable to go to North Korea, not only just for the reasons you brought up, that, like, you know, you come back with a lot of questions and you will have your questions ready for the experts on the South Korea trip, but also I think because you will always make comparisons and it's easier to, you know, have the reverse shock that you go to the less well-to-do, more shocking country first, and then you go to like a Western democracy type of country, because then it's easier to process the differences, I believe so. Yeah. And you won't be focusing on that much on the obvious differences if as if it was the other way around.
It's interesting,
I do agree.
It's something that I thought a bit about, the you know, which way around. And the only thing that I would say there is when I went to North Korea, certainly the first time, you do go in with so many, you go in, it's not baggage, but you just go in with preconceptions. Yeah. So I would see things and think of them being, oh, that's North Korea. I now know I saw some of those same things in the more rural parts of South Korea. Yeah. I went, no, not North Korean. That's right. Regional Korean. That's just, you know, because we have perceptions of both South and North. We have perceptions of the North as being very grey and dreary and dangerous, and, you know, and we have these perceptions of South Korea being tall, silver, shiny buildings. But actually, one of the interesting things of the trip was getting outside the big cities like Seoul and going into the countryside and seeing how people live and subsist. Who aren't wealthy Seoulites. So there were actually, we're getting, I guess, a bit into the comparison, but there were things that I realised, oh, that was an absolute assumption on my part in North Korea, because I knew nothing about Korea at all when I went there. So it's a bit of both.
Sorry, Leslie has an amazing collection of comparisons on her Instagram.
Oh, okay.
Like she has a very good eye to pick up these similarities and capturing them.
As I went through the trip, I was seeing things. There were actually moments where I was sort of going, oh, which Korea am I in? And so I sort of sat down, I was seeing things and I was thinking, I saw something just like that in North Korea. So when I, at the end of the trip, I did do a little Instagram series where I didn't say where the photos were.
That's interesting.
So you could look at it and sort of, it was like, it's almost like a trivia quiz. Is this South Korea or is this North Korea? You know,
I will. So. Yeah. I'll pop your Instagram in the show notes, Leslie, but can you just tell us how we can find you on Instagram?
So on Instagram, I'm FolioPix, which is FolioPix.
Excellent. Folio. And I'll put that in the show notes as well. I think it's super interesting. So we just brought up earlier about the South Korean history, and just to tie all of that together, I want to urge listeners to look into South Korean history a little bit if you are interested in North Korea at all, because it's really interesting. It's something that I didn't know. I had no idea that South Korea wasn't this big capitalist democracy that we know it today. I was born in the 90s, so I've grown up with South Korea as the capitalist entity that we know it today, and this big democracy and stuff like that. But when you look at its very recent history, it's really not. And it's very interesting to see that, you know, at first, North Korea's economy was, you know, growing better than South Korea's, which a lot of people don't know. It wasn't long until South Korea took over, you know, but it's still very interesting to view it that way. And I think, Leslie, what you were saying before as well about the comparisons, it must be very interesting to leave the South Korean city life and see that these two countries have not been separated for a long time. And I'm sure that going out of the big cities in South Korea, you can probably see a lot more of the similarities.
Absolutely.
That is inherently just Korean culture. It's not South Korean, it's not North Korean, it's just Korean, because it hasn't been that long since they've been separated. And it's nice to hear that, you know, you can see those kind of things still in South Korea as well.
But as far as looking at the
South Korean comparison from a trip point of view, the North Korean thing almost has to be a visual experience more than anything else with a limited conversation. The South Korean one is visual, but a huge amount of conversation with highly informed people about the Korean situation. So in North Korea, you get the North Korean experience. Fair enough, that's what you would expect. In South Korea, you get the South Korean experience, but you also get the North Korean experience. There are specialists on that trip that know North Korea backwards, and they've got a huge amount to add to the whole thing. So that's why I say North Korea first, you can get the visual experience, but if you want the intellectual experience, particularly on our trip, I don't know whether every trip's going to be organised like ours, but there were very, very high quality people there. You know, I don't know how many trips around the world get organised where the advisor to the American president was there. You know, I mean, this doesn't happen. You know, I mean, that was the level of what the trip was run in South Korea, at a very high level. There was the political advisor to the Japanese embassy in Seoul was there. Now, the Japanese-Korean history is a very problematic history, to say the least. And there's a huge amount of Korean history there, the Chinese influence, the Japanese influence in particular. There's a huge amount to learn. Now, you're restricted in North Korea just simply because you're in a bubble. Mm. But in South Korea, you're not in a bubble. It all comes out. It all comes out. And it's fascinating.
There were certainly questions, you know, it's absolutely true. There were some really big questions that I had not been able to settle in my mind. You know, one of the major ones being, why would North Korea attack the South? Like, you'd be insane. But actually, I was able to ask experts those questions and actually get an answer that sort of made sense, you know.
Can we hear the answer?
Well, it's not, you know, we think of, the North is going to attack the South and take over and turn it into this one country run by the Kims. But really, it would be more about invading the top of the South, which is fantastic agricultural land, and they're short on agricultural land, and then actually using that partly as leverage. So this idea of the Kims as being cartoon characters and being insane is not right. But they do have a strategy that these very smart people in the South understand, which is they would come over the border, but then they would basically use it as blackmail to get certain concessions and probably keep some of that land. It would not be unlike what's happened in Russia in that eastern part that they've taken off Ukraine. You know, there's certain parts of South Korea the Kims would really like to have, but they're not going to go to Seoul. So it's those really big questions that you're thinking, I just don't really understand this. I need someone to answer that. And I had some of those questions answered. Doesn't mean that person was right that told me that, but that was a theory. I thought, yeah, actually, I get that. Yeah.
See, there's several interesting things just happened in the last couple of weeks. For the first time, North Korea is now talking about South Korea as a separate country. And I picked this up on the podcasts that were from NK News. Now, that's never happened before because the unification thing's been absolutely huge.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
But the North Koreans almost seem to be testing out now whether the unification thing's really not going to work at all. And we've got to take our own path on this thing. And NK News made that point the other day, that there's conversations taking place in North Korea now about whether they should treat themselves separately. And this has enormous ramifications. For instance, the northern separation line out in the ocean is actually an armistice line. Now, if they're two separate countries, that line changes dramatically under international law. So there's a whole lot of things going on just underneath the surface. And on top of that, North Korea has been backed into a corner. It's under enormous sanctions at the moment. And it can't carry on the way it's going. Something's got to give. I mean, if there's a breakout, you know, I got the impression when I was in South Korea. Now, South Korea wouldn't agree with this because they live with it every day of the week. But quite frankly, for me, if war had broken out tomorrow, I wouldn't have been surprised. I mean, the place is so tense. There's military all over the place. Mm. Anything could go wrong at any point in time. And on that Yongkyong Island, that did happen back in 2010. You know, the North Koreans started shelling it. And an interesting thing that came out of that was the Americans had to hold back the Koreans. You know, there's always the danger of thinking the North Koreans are behind every evil thing that goes on. But the American Marines were saying that one of their main reasons for being in South Korea is to hold back the South Koreans. And we saw this on the border also. The South Koreans had moved in one place we went to, and Greg would, I think, was referring to this before. the South Koreans had moved their fighting positions well into the demilitarized zone. And the fact that the Marines were saying that 80% of the problems they have are with South Koreans, not North Koreans. Now, that's not generally known, but you've got to do a trip like this to sort of understand these things. It's very, very complex. And Koreans also basically don't like outsiders. You know, they're nationalistic to the extreme, you know. And there's a, you know, they don't like outsiders at all. I think that's right, isn't it, Greg? Am I, I'm not exaggerating, am I?
No.
Yeah.
No, and actually, just to pick up on, you know, the main reason why Americans is there, is like, yeah, I'm 100% positive that South Korea would have started the Korean War if the Americans and Truman didn't hold them back. So that's why the Americans kept all weaponry for South Korea so low, because Syngman Rhee was petitioning Truman to let him to attack the North. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I do agree with you that American presence is needed so that we avoid any conflict. Mm-hmm. And yes, Koreans, let it be North or South Koreans, can be extremely nationalistic. Nationalistic, patriotic, determined.
Almost racist, to the point of almost being racist, mate.
But I don't think we can apply Western concepts of racism in East Asia. It's more like an ignorance and chauvinism. Mm-hmm. I was thinking like for after, like during the 5 years I spent in China and North Korea, China and Korea, I was thinking a lot about this concept of like to what extent East Asians are racist, and I don't think that we can describe that with Western concepts of racism. It's more like a complex of chauvinism and ignorance.
Mm. And pride,
ignorance to the political debates going on in the West, the lack of knowledge of political correctness, the lack of the experience of like the Holocaust, which is did influence Western thinking for sure after 1945. But it would lead us to a different.
Let's get back to things.
If I can apply that to the tour, like as a woman traveling on her own, and let's face it, that you know, like my husband would have wanted to come on that tour, so right. I went on my own. So I spent time in Korea on my own, just as a tourist, just for 10 days. But actually, I don't know. Maybe it's because of my age. Maybe because I was on my own. A friend of mine who has lived in Korea for many years said, if you go on your own, you will be adopted. And I actually had fantastic experiences with Korean people who saw that I was on my own, usually looking a bit lost. So I just to balance that, it was a great place to visit.
That's because they knew that you only came for
different things.
Yeah, and I think that I don't want to carry on with this topic so much, but I do find it interesting, Greg's point of, you know, it's I don't know, you know, it's different from Western style racism and stuff, but it reminds me very much of, you know, in Japan and in Taiwan, especially, I really feel that they are so welcoming to foreigners. And as a tourist, you are completely welcomed in and you will be treated amazingly. Nothing like you would be treated in the West. You know, in the UK, you get treated like rubbish as a foreigner half the time as a tourist, you know, but there is a very big limit to this welcomeness and to this kindness. And that limit is when you start to want to be in the country permanently and, you know, you've overstayed your welcome and you definitely start to feel like that in East Asia. But I don't want to get into that too much because I do want to carry on with this tour. So we keep speaking about the guest speakers and they keep popping up. So I want to cover this topic a little bit because guest speakers are not a normal thing that you have on tour. And a lot of people might be curious as to why we keep talking about guest speakers. And maybe Greg, you can start with a bit of an introduction and then Leslie and Pete, you can kind of chime in with, you know, anything that you want to. But Greg, can you just introduce the concept of having guest speakers on tour? who we have to a certain extent, because I understand that some of the names cannot be mentioned for whatever reason, but what type of demographic that you have and how you pick those guest speakers and stuff like that, and what the general concept of the guest speaker is. Do we have to sit in lectures every night, you know?
Oh, you never have to do anything. You can always leave. And some people did so because some of the converts, like you know, usually, so what happened, and it will be different this time. We won't have dinner together because that to a certain extent, wouldn't say disastrous, but it wasn't the best solution. So we will have some kind of lectures, and then whoever wants to, you know, go have dinner can go have dinner. So basically the idea is that we have like kind of an introductory lecture, and then we open the floor for discussion and questions. And that's the most interesting part, actually. Because as I said, questions, I always learn more from questions than anything else. So basically, we have specialists or experts on some days related to the visit of to that day. For example, when we had our visit to the JSA, we had someone who worked in that area and who worked together with North Koreans in the JSA. And he himself enjoyed the tour so much that he decided to join us for dinner and then for drinks afterwards. Mm-hmm. So basically, he came on the tour for the whole day, guiding us through the JSA and the JSA area. And then we had, he didn't have like really a lecture, but we had conversations during dinner and over drinks. And all kinds of questions popped up. For example, Peter throughout the whole tour wanted to learn why Americans are still there. And I think one of the biggest conversations about this topic was with this person. Then we have people who have good understanding of the DMZ, how DMZ is working, the changes in the area, but also he is a kind of a distinguished guest speaker, so he talks about the situation on the peninsula, so he also brought in some aspects of Korean society today, historical perspectives, and some very interesting remarks on North Korean political developments as well, and how he sees the North Korean regime. It was quite interesting, and as he pointed out, it would have been a dangerous statement 20 years ago in South Korea. He basically said that President Kim Il-sung was actually working for the Korean people. Mm-hmm. And then we also have some more specific areas, which I don't really want to go into details, but that was the more classic, like lecture and then Q&As. And also we had a chance to sit down with some of the NK News staff to learn. And that was quite, it was a quite reassuring experience for me, because I'm always skeptical about everything which is in the media in North Korea. And even though I knew Chad, I didn't know the process they work. And they described us how they put together an article, how they work on a story, what do they publish, what do they don't publish, what is the criteria for publishing. And you learn that there are still reliable journalists.
Yeah. As a former journalist, I was very impressed with that. Yeah.
Like, you know, how you make sure that what you provide as an information is accurate, or if not necessarily 100% accurate, you make sure that the audience knows about it. Mm. I think that was, after Professor Lankov, for me personally, the NK News lecture was the most enlightening, because that's one of my primary sources about North Korea, especially these days. Mm-hmm. And to learn about the processes and the ethics behind it was reassuring and eye-opening.
Actually, I'd say to you that we use that you're using the word lecture, but just remember this is only 20 people on a tour too. So this is a very intimate environment, you know. So you're not sitting in a big room and someone's talking at you to 100 people. This is 20 people sitting around a table. So it's fantastic. Yeah.
I'll tell you an interesting story about Professor Lankoff, actually. I was talking to him one day because he was professor at ANU University in Australia, you know, a top position in Australia. Then he went to South Korea, and I asked him why. He said, mate, I was just getting bored stupid in Canberra. You know, so...
If you've been to Canberra, you'd know.
He was a guy that was following his passion. He went to South Korea, and he could have lived a very easy life in Canberra, ANU and all the rest, the top professorship, the whole lot, but he went to South Korea to live his passion, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Yeah. Definitely sounds more like perhaps we can describe it like a seminar. We would call this kind of thing like a seminar instead of a lecture, where it's you know, in British universities anyway, where it's kind of like the lecture's there and like they might introduce a topic, but it's more about group discussion and stuff. So
yeah.
I'm very jealous actually. Yeah.
Q&A with a 20-minute introduction or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, like a structured Q&A. So yeah. This is in the evening times, or this is, you know, as part of a lecture or a set time, but we're still on tour, right? We're still traveling. The main aspect of this, apart from the learning, is still the travel. So I want to talk a little bit about the itinerary and the things that you get up to. And I want to kind of start that maybe with asking Leslie and Pete, what are your favorite things on the itinerary, or your most memorable, or the most shocking, or, you know, pick something and let me know. Pete, do you want to go first?
Yeah, okay. Look, I think one of the highlights of the trip for me was on Yongpyong Island. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a seawall there. I mean, Yongpyong, you've got to understand, is where we were, in one part of it anyhow, is only a few kilometres from the northern limit line, which divides North Korea and South. It's probably only 500 metres offshore. And we were walking along the beach there, and there was a seawall there that had machine gun posts built into the wall. And I thought, you know, if I was in Manly walking along a beach there and there was a seawall there with machine gun posts built into the wall, what on earth would I think? And, you know, that type of thing really stuck with me. When you see that, and particularly when you remember that Yongpyong Island was artilleryed very badly in 2010, you realise war could break out at any moment. And this is something South Koreans sort of, they live with it every day and they forget about it. But I came away from South Korea thinking, and particularly now when the tensions are really building up, that war could break out at any moment. And Professor Lankoff said that the thing that really worried him was that he was really concerned that the North Koreans are going to start moving towards tactical nuclear weapons, because it's the only way they're ever going to beat the South. And straight after we left, the North Koreans announced that, you know, that they were going to move. So the whole of that area, war could break out at any moment. You know, I almost feel like I'm in Poland in 1938, you know. And you're just sitting there watching it, and everyone else is oblivious to it. If you're an outsider going in, you really see it. But if you live there, you live with it so long, people just accept it. You know, and you come out of Seoul and you go down the river there. I forget what the name of the river is. And it's got barbed wire all the way down it to keep out infiltrators and all the rest. And you see all that, and people live with it every day, and they just accept it. But, you know, to me, it was just a shock to go there and just realise, particularly when you follow what's happened in the news recently, that, you know, things could go very bad very, very quickly, you know. I don't know what you thought. I don't know what your view was there, Leslie.
Yeah, look, Yongpyongdo was absolutely a highlight, because you were really... this is not a tourist town. This is a little island with a seafood industry, and I can't remember the population, but it is not many.
5,000. Wow.
Yeah, 5,000.
And 4,000 were troops.
Yeah, wow. That's right. I was going to say the actual villages, if you like, if you took away the troops, it's probably 500 people. So that was fascinating to go there. One small highlight, and you guys found the cafe, Peter, but we went back, and the woman proprietor there, she'd actually been on the island. She was there when it was shelled. But, you know, the interesting thing, Peter, like you're saying, the attitude to it. So I asked, with the help of someone who spoke Korean, obviously, you know, what was it like you know, what did it feel like? And do you know her, that what she said was, oh, it was great because all these international journalists came to my cafe. You know, so that was, no, just a completely different perspective on it. I sort of expected her to say, you know, it was terrible or it was scary or whatever, but she saw it, I guess she's a small businesswoman, you know, she saw it as, oh, it was amazing because all these international, look at my photos with these international journalists on the wall. Wow. So that was kind of interesting and just sort of, yeah, emblematic of the way Koreans have come to live with this, I think. But also, yeah, I mean, there was those similarities, like, in North Korea, you know, we saw the tank traps, the wire fencing along the coast when you're going to Wonsan and up to Kumgangsan. But the same things, we saw the tank traps, we saw the wire fences, you know, when we were up by Sokcho, we stayed in this beautiful hotel, I can't remember the Ramadan or whatever it was, but then you walk down the road and there's a beach, but there's also, you know, this wire fencing and warnings and security cameras looking everywhere. So you do realise that there is, you know, just under the surface, there is this tension and... yeah, there's an impact on the south as well as the north. There's those similarities.
Definitely.
And you can talk about this in South Korea on the South Korean trip, but you couldn't do it on the North Korean trip.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, the South Korean trip was conversation all the time. The North Korean trip, you had to really watch what you say. You had to be respectful, and I understand all of that, but the conversation could only go so far. Mm. You know, in fact, I found in North Korea the most interesting conversations I had where when the girl guys were getting a bit drunk at night and you got a bit of wine and beer into them, and then they'd start talking about what they wanted to talk about. And they're just other people, you know, they want to talk about their boyfriends, about their clothes and all the rest. And I used to love those conversations. They were some of the few conversations that you genuinely felt people were saying what they felt. But the rest of it in North Korea was so curated, it didn't have the same value as the conversations in South Korea.
Yeah, I often go on.
So, I was going to say, I also love the way there was just, I'm a bit of a visual person, as Greg will have picked up on, but I, you know, there was just funny little highlights. I love the bus. You know, the bus, yeah, the bus was sort of Baroque, a bit 1960s or 70s, or very comfortable, but just the decorations in the bus, I don't know if that was deliberately chosen to be a bit North Korean. I don't know. It wasn't. Yep. It was amazing. It was so funny. And then the hotel we stayed at, which I've forgotten the name of, it was on one of the beaches.
The condo.
So, and that, I mean, and I know that was deliberately chosen to sort of give that sense of, you know, something in the south that was a bit like the North Korea. It was a bit like being at Yanggakdo. In fact, I shouldn't tell which, but that's two comparison shots with a foyer of the condo and the foyer of the Yanggakdo.
So why is it so similar?
I look at those photos and go, hang on, which one's which? You know? So. Yeah.
What, the interior design is very North Korean. Yeah.
But I mean, like, why? Like, where does that stem from? Like, why? Why has it been deliberately done so, or is it because approximation to the border? Is it? It could just be
like why the buses are similar.
Okay.
So it's that idea again that when we're in the Yanggakdo in the north, we think, oh, this is North Korean. Right. This is what hotels are like in North Korea. No, that's the same as a 2.5-star hotel in South Korea. And my understanding is that normally they don't let international tourists go to that
same
hotel.
As in China.
Yeah, because that's a local hotel, you know. So we weren't meant to go there, but they sort of convinced them that we should go there. Yeah. So again, that idea of it's not North Korean, it's just a certain hotel.
Which is also the same thing. There are some hotels that you can't go to as a foreigner in North Korea for the exact same reasons. You know, it's an embarrassment to them. They think that it's not good enough. And it's the same in South Korea and also same in China. But
yeah, but in South Korea, there's no legal...
No, legally,
to go. It's just, again, the Korean mindset that there are certain things which is only for Koreans, because Koreans are so different from foreigners that foreigners couldn't take it, and then it would reflect bad upon us. Yeah.
Yeah. Comparisons. Let's chat about those for a little bit, because I know we don't have so much time left, but I find that very interesting. And I think we've brought it up quite a lot, and probably all of our listeners are interested in, since you've both been to North Korea, all three of you have been to North Korea, and then also been on the South Korea trip. What are some big comparisons that maybe we haven't already mentioned that you wanted to mention that, you know, really struck you, or any similarities as well? You can also mention.
I think people can be very similar, like how they talk, how they react to certain things, certain facial expressions. Mm. That I found fascinating.
Even, you know, they like a drink, and when they've had a drink, they like a song.
Yeah.
You know, that's a similarity. It's just, it's there are certain things that are just, not North or South, just Korean. So. Mm.
And how about since, I know you went in 2015 and 2018, it was Leslie, did you see any comparisons between those two times in North Korea?
Oh, absolutely. Like again, for me, the visual thing. So when I went in 2015, I felt like I was in a time machine. If we, I'm sort of talking in a way here about style, fashion, dress, you know. Mm. I felt like I was in a time machine and I was in the 1970s. So I have photos of the clothes that people were wearing. Women had just, women were not allowed to wear trousers for a long time, but they were wearing these sort of flared pants. This was so 1970s. It was amazing. Mm-hmm. 3 years later, we were in the 1990s bordering on early 2000s. You know, that's the amount of change. Like people were dressing differently, much smarter clothes, a different style of clothes. I saw women wearing what I would call funky shoes, you know, like it was so interesting. In 3 years, that amount of change was incredible. Peter, did you, oh, that's right, you only went once and then COVID shut everything down. Yeah. So to me, I would be tempted to go back again to see how fast the clock has or hasn't moved, I would suspect, because of the
situation. Or move backwards.
Yeah,
yes, exactly. Unfortunately.
Because of sanctions and COVID, it could well have gone very much backwards.
Definitely. Peter, did you have anything that you wanted to say on comparisons?
Yeah, look, one of the most amazing things I found about North Korea was the Songbun system of social stratification. You're born at a certain level, depending on what your father or your grandfather did. And I believe it goes on for five generations. But if you're born in the wrong situation in North Korea, your life is hell forever and you can never get out of it. I mean, if your father was a worked for the Japanese in the Second World War, and he was a high level official, and you got caught in North Korea, mate, you'd be right at the bottom level. And I believe there's something like 50 stratifications in this. So I just found, of course, you don't get that in South Korea, but I found that whole social classification system just amazing. Now, you'll never see it on tour because the people we were traveling with, the guides and all the rest, are obviously the top level of that. But it's a hugely stratified society. You know, very few people with any sort of class live in Pyongyang. But, you know, there are people living out in the country that are living on $2 or $3 a month. Now, you don't see this on tour, but I know this from additional reading. But that Songbun system, that classification system, is just horrendous.
Although the Songbun system has been abandoned to, like many people believe that it's not in practice anymore, especially when it comes to potential success in business. So it used to be very rigid and it used to be there, but now it's either non-existent anymore or less observed.
Yeah, I mean, North Korea today, it is about money. You know, like if you have money, you can buy your way out of Songbun.
Yeah, my understanding and following from your point there is when the North Korean economy started to open up and there's a bit of free enterprise, the Songbun system fell a wee bit to one side. It was all about money.
Exactly.
And so that's what's happened. It's the money thing that's changed it. But nevertheless, underneath it all, it's a hugely stratified society.
Mm.
You've got to buy your way out of it.
Yeah, and obviously it's not Songbun in South Korea, but in South Korea there is also not similar at all, but still, your social status defines your whole career, let it be because of your economic background or the hometown. So if certain politicians are in power and that politician is from a certain area, then suddenly the whole administration is going to be recruited from that area. So let's say that the president of South Korea is from Gangwon province, then suddenly everyone who has connection to Gangwon province will get better chances. If they went to the same university, then people from that university will have more chances in advancement in the government. If they went to the same army branch, then that army branch will be also favored. And it works not only just on presidential level, it works in all strata of South Korean society.
You look at what university you went to, how much money have you got to pay to go to the cram school to get into the university, which means you get the, you know, the right job and the best company. So, you know, there are different issues at play in South Korean society.
I tell you, one issue that fascinated me was the focus on facial surgery or plastic surgery in South Korea.
Yeah. It's the getting most there in North Korea.
You know, sure as hell there. Don't see that in Korea, I can tell you.
It seems to be potentially
raises another thing about South Korea. Appearance means a hell of a lot, you know. And so girls will use plastic surgery to the nth degree. You'll never see that in North Korea. But the appearance thing, that Asian appearance thing and all the rest, is very important there. I couldn't care less. You only have to look at the way I'm dressed to work that out, you know.
I would arguably say that that's a similarity that both North and South Korea have, is that appearance is everything. And you especially see that potentially not so much in the countryside in North Korea, but especially in Pyongyang, appearance really is everything. And you, as a person that lives in Pyongyang, you're expected to dress in a certain way. And I don't just mean you're expected to wear nice clothes, but you are expected to look good. Like, your hair should be done nicely. You should have good makeup on as a woman. You should be wearing high heels around. You know, I've never seen someone not wearing high heels as a woman in Pyongyang. And I remember going out to the countryside with a couple of female guides that I often work with. And it was their first time in this, in the Northeast. I think it was their first time. And we'd gone shopping and they'd seen these leggings that were, you know, pretty chilled and pretty, you know, probably from China. They were the most, you know, pretty casual leggings, and they were so excited to wear them in where we were staying. We were actually staying in the homestay, and they were excited to wear them, and they would not come out of the house with them on. They were like, we're not usually allowed to wear these, like, is it fine? And I was like, come on, girls, like, I'm literally wearing the most casual thing, like, it's fine to walk around like that here. And they're like, we're not used to doing this. And so
never did Pyongyang.
And interestingly, the plastic surgery thing has started to be a thing in North Korea. I think that the only thing that's stopping it is unfortunately the availability. I think that if it had the availability like it does in South Korea, then North Korea would unfortunately follow the same path, because I know girls who have had plastic surgery in North Korea. The popular ones at the moment, and again, I think this is only because of availability, is the eyelid surgery that's very common in Asia that, you know, gives you the double eyelids. But I know that other girls have had other operations as well. So it was at least starting to come into the country pre-COVID. Let's see what's happening post-COVID.
Another difference too. You can get in terrible trouble in North Korea now if you start using South Korean slang. So the languages are changing, and you've really got to watch it in North Korea. It's become very socially at a certain level. They use South Korean terms in North Korea, but if you get caught doing that, there's a terrible punishment there. So they're trying to keep the languages separate. You know, it's not as though they're trying to have a commonality because we're Koreans. They're actually trying to create a separation.
It's also a sign too, though, that those people have been watching K-drama.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And it's like evidence of, you know.
Yeah. It's less of trying to create separation and more of a preservation of the Korean language, I think, is more that the North Koreans have an issue with, is that there are lots of English language words that have got into the South Korean vocabulary more and more so every year. And I think that's one thing that, you know, PD, as you rightly say, they are very different on, but I think it's more of a wanting to preserve the precious Korean language and lest, you know, the Western words get in. So I'm just going to move the conversation a little bit. Greg, did you have a favorite itinerary item? Give us it quickly, if you do. Or yeah, some highlight. Tough. What's the highlight for you?
Charmon Victoria Observatory. That was a first for me as well.
Yeah.
And all the conversations on the bus or walking from the barbed wire fence to the seafood restaurant in Sokcho with Leslie, for example. I think that's where we had our first conversation. Or running into Peter and his company in Ibis and then go out for dinner. all the conversations.
Excellent. I think it's so interesting because the things that stand out to me on the itinerary are probably not the things that you brought up, but I'm just looking at it from, you know, an outsider's perspective. I haven't been on the tour yet. And for me, the things that really stood out are the highly North Korea related things, I guess, for example, and just super simple things like finding the trash on the beach and stuff, mm-hmm. like the North Korean trash. I think we haven't mentioned it yet, but that's something that I find really interesting and that I think a lot of people could find interesting too, is that, you know, that you go for searching on the beach for North Korean trash that's kind of washed up. And at that point as well,
you find Chinese trash instead.
Oh, Chinese trash.
That's true.
And I
made it like finding gold when you did find something, you know. Yeah. It's like,
did you guys find something?
Yeah, like I felt like one or two things, but it was like gold. Like you go, is this something? No. Is this something? No. And then finally they go, yeah, that's a North Korean chip packet or something, you know. Yeah. So
that should have been a garbage collector, mate, because he knew when it came from North Korea and South Korea, he knew all about garbage. He knew all about a lot of things, including garbage, okay?
It's hilarious being able to make something so mundane sounds so exciting, but that just, I guess, is because of this illusion of North Korea as being this crazy it's enigma that we can never get anything from and stuff like that. So finding North Korean trash, it's like, oh my gosh, and listening to the North Korean radio channel and stuff like that as well is something you can do there, right? That's on the itinerary, that's at least listed.
I'm sure we could, but we didn't have the actual channel and bring it.
Yeah. And at the gift shop, I had one question on the itinerary. At the gift shop or at the gift shop, are there any of the observatories and stuff like that? Was there any interesting North Korean products? Was there really not? Or was there something that surprised you or something that didn't? Did anyone pick up any souvenirs?
I found it sort of raises one thing for me. When we went to Injimjak, I actually felt a little bit disturbed by the sort of theme park element to that particular area. Again, it's that, you know, they live with it all the time, so to them it's sort of, they have a different attitude to it, whereas I thought, okay, so we're coming to this place which is actually a very serious place, but there's a Ferris wheel, Dunkin' Donuts, and then there was a souvenir store, you know, with really sort of, you know, tacky things that I wouldn't buy. Yeah. So I felt conflicted there. You know, at the same time, there was a fantastic sort of exhibition up in a hall that we went to have a look at. So I just found that contrast sometimes between, you know, Korean division, Korean War being turned into a theme park. It wasn't like that at every place, but in that spot, I felt it was. Yeah.
And you just reminded me of how I felt as well. So I recently went to Dandong. If you guys remember, it's on the North Korean border. It's often how you go into North Korea. And obviously we're not allowed to go into North Korea just yet. It's still closed from COVID. And, you know, throughout my whole time working in North Korea, people often say to me like, oh, you know, does it not just feel like a zoo? Like you're looking at people, like, and you know, you're watching a play and these actors and stuff like that. And weirdly enough, that's how I kind of felt when I was in Dandong. I felt that I was looking at something and like it was this, you know, why am I looking at this thing and thinking like, oh my God, isn't it crazy? Like over there's North Korea. And I felt that for the first time. And I feel like going to North Korea, it's not really like that, you know, at all. But when you are looking into it and not really getting into it in depth, then it does kind of feel like that. So
I think it was Odesan, another observatory, and there was a cafe and you got your coffee and we got an ice cream, and then you sat there and you stared out the windows at the village across the estuary. And again, I felt uncomfortable about that bit because it did feel like, oh, it's a day trip on a Saturday. Let's go and look at the North Koreans.
Right, yeah.
But at the same time, downstairs, absolutely fantastic exhibition about, you know, family division, really, really moving. So there's just these contrasts, you know. There's sort of a commodification of it on one hand, but also, you know, some deep thinking about it on the other. And that's probably the split in society where you've got the younger generation, it's less real to them. You've got the older generation who probably still have, you know, who potentially still have older relatives, and that's actually going to move and move and move. So, you know, the research is showing that for the younger generation, it's not relevant. It's not relevant anymore.
Yeah. But also, if you...
conflicts, yeah.
If you understand some Korean and you listen to what Koreans say when they look at North Korea, that's also quite disturbing. So, like, they talk, it's like a zoo, like, look at North Korean, two North Koreans.
Yeah.
And then.
And Professor Lankov gave that context, actually. So that was, this was another thing I learned on the trip, because I remember thinking, jeepers, how many observatories are there? Like, I lost count of how many we did go to. And he explained towards the end of the trip that actually this was a form of propaganda. They were actually built to show the poverty under communism. You know, look across the river, you know, look how poor those people are and how hard their lives are. So the government put money into these observatories for that reason. So, when you start to learn some of the context from people like Professor Longkov, it's very, very interesting. And it teaches you there's propaganda on both sides.
And I think just whilst we're kind of on the border and at the observatories as well, the other big itinerary item is, of course, the JSA, which is the DMZ that everyone knows. And I think what I probably should have made clear at the start here is that even though it's kind of intuitive once you think about it, the DMZ, the borderline between North and South, is not just this tiny area of blue huts that everyone sees on the media. It does actually go through the entire country from east to west, which you are traveling on this tour. Yeah. But most people know the DMZ as the blue huts area. And funnily enough, I often say that it's easier to visit from the North Korean side. And I don't think that I'm kind of wrong in saying that. Greg, you might have something to say in that. But the JSA often from the South Korean side gets blocked or gets, you know, tours there get shut off for whatever reason. Something that potentially might happen due to recent events with, this is coming out, this is going to be published a couple of weeks after we're recording this now. So let's see kind of what comes of that. American who has, crossed over the line from a South Korean tour into the North. But that's something that, interestingly enough, stands out as a massive itinerary item, but we haven't even talked about it. So I feel like this tour is something that's so special that has all of these massive itinerary items on it, but in reality, it's everything else that really helps to kind of build it up. And so on that note, I wanted to ask, just before we wrap things up, if there was anything that anyone wants to say on any of the topics that, you know, we've said, if you have any kind of memorable moments or last words. If you don't, that's fine. But if you have something that you want to say, say it now.
Okay. I'll tell you, one of my highlights actually at night was dining with the American Marine officer. He always used to keep my beer mug full. So I always used to try to sit next to them. It's like having your own valet, you know, always keep my beer mug full. But it was fantastic. I mean, I learned so much from the American Armed Forces on that thing. There's some highly intelligent people there. These were area officers that had gone to Korean school to study Korean. They were advising the American generals there on how to handle the political situation. And I got a lot more appreciation for what America does in South Korea. And they'd certainly held back a lot of situations that could have run out of control. You know, their main job was not actually the defense of South Korea. It was keeping the South Korean army under control.
Mm-hmm.
You won't see that, but that's what the Marine officers told me. He said, our real problem is a lot of the problems on the DMZ are actually caused by South Koreans. He said, our job is to keep these guys under control.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I went in, I've got to admit, I really went in with fairly strong opinions about America being in South Korea. Why are they still there? You know, Korea should be making its own decisions now. And actually, I did come away with sort of understanding the nuances, which is not to say it's a perfect relationship and that the US always does the right thing, but there is absolutely, it's a much more nuanced relationship than I had understood until I went on this tour. I thought that was a real takeaway. Yeah.
I guess it's one more similarity to the North and South Koreans tours that we all have a more nuanced and less black and white understanding ideas about the peninsula or the countries.
So that's exactly right. I think the tour to the north, the tour to the south, they were both they were great. There were great learnings, and to unpack what your preconceptions, to bust some of those myths on both sides, you know, on both sides of the border.
Absolutely.
Mm. Well, honestly, go on, say.
People are people at the end of the day, and you've really got to do a trip to both if you really want to understand what's going on, and then you understand maybe 10% of it. It's very, very complex. But just to go to either North Korea or South Korea, you end up with a distorted view. You really need to go to both.
Yeah. Well, honestly, I don't know about our listeners, but you have definitely sold the tour to me. I did actually ask Greg if I could come on the tour. So let's see what happens with that. No, I would love to visit, you know, and come on the tour, at least if not this year, potentially in the next few years. You've definitely sold it to me anyway. For our listeners, how you can get on this tour. I don't know how many spots that are left. And like I said, this is going to be published a couple of weeks after we are recording. So there will still be a chance for you to sign up, hopefully, because there are very limited spots on the tour. As Leslie mentioned before, they are very small groups. Greg, as of right now, do you know how many spots we still have left?
Well, between 5 and 10, it's always changing depending on.
It was down to 8, I think, about 2 weeks ago, mate. I got an email saying there's 8 spots left. You want to come and do it again?
Excellent. So there is a few spots left, at least as of today. So if you do want to join, then the tour is in the show notes. You can also go on the Koryo Tours website, koryogroup.com, or you can just email Greg on greg@koryotours.com. Or is it
greg@koryogroup.com.
What did I
say? You're running the next one too, are you?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
Okay. Greg, tell me, one question for you. What was your overall assessment of that trip? I mean, you've got our views, Leslie and myself. But Greg, what did you think of that trip? Did it meet expectations or what?
It was beyond my expectations for sure. Not so for the visual, because I've been to many places, but as I said, how certain preconceptions I had, even though I didn't think that I have that many change about journalism and Americans, that was really eye-opening for me, as I pointed out. I never expected that I would come back from that tour with these new views or aspects. For me, that was the biggest change. And personally, it was just good to be back in what I always liked doing, leading a tour and talking to people who travel to learn, not to, you know, put on a Facebook post.
Excellent. So, Greg, can I get your email right? Can you say your email for me?
Greg, G-R-E-G, at koryogroup.com.
Excellent. Greg@koryogroup.com. And that email will be in the show notes as well, just as the link for this tour and Leslie's Instagram once again, which I've forgotten what it is. Can you say it once again, Leslie?
So it's FolioPix, which is FolioPix.
Awesome. That will be in the show notes as well. Anyone else got anything they want to plug? Greg, you want to plug your Instagram? Pete, you've got an Instagram you want to plug?
Not an Instagram. I've only got an email address.
If people want to contact you.
I think you've got the email address, so that shouldn't be a problem.
I'll put it in the show notes as well. So thank you very much for joining me, all of you. It was really fascinating. I learned a lot. I hope the listeners also learned a lot. So a massive thank you. And thanks for coming on the show. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for the invite, mate. It was great fun.
Thank you.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.